This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, April 29th, 2009.
Okay, so make sure everybody signs in. And are there any reports from the constituent assembly, starting with the student assembly first?
Sure. So a lot of people, I guess, saw in the Daily Sun and other different issues. Our big issue last week was dealing with Chi Alpha and their funding and also the student registered student organization on campus. So there was a big debate from various different communities on campus that came to our meeting to discuss the merits of both the resolution that was brought forth to analyze whether Chi Alpha was in conflict with university policies. And then there was also the Chi Alpha voice that was there saying that, you know, we don't think that we did anything wrong. So it was a play between the two. Processes are currently underway by the Student Activities Office as well as the SAFC to evaluate what they've done in terms of Chi Alpha over the past few semesters. And we are awaiting updates on the situation. And then we'll update that.
Congratulations to ASA for our next student trustee. GPSA?
We finally passed our charter after a long series of charter reviews. So we're very happy about that, and they elected new officers for next year.
And there's nobody here from the EA except me, and I didn't go to the meeting, so I don't know. And faculty senate?
No.
Okay. Next is the approval of the minutes from the last meeting. Would anybody like to move those?
I just have we need to move it for
a minute.
Second.
First by
Natalie.
And seconded by James.
Jane Ware.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I just wanted to say, so the David Kroheim and Evan Magruder, before they started speaking, they kind of gave a disclaimer that made it a point that they weren't giving legal opinions because they're not members of the bar yet, so they were giving legal context.
Okay.
So it says, one sentence says that they were invited by me to provide their legal opinions. I suggest changing that to provide legal context. And then also in the next sentence, say that banning swimming in the gorges, currently read banning swimming in the gorges would violate the easement, and I would change that to could.
Okay. Any others? If not, all in favor?
There was an administrative word missing. I did see it because somebody's quote was missing already. It was about the gorge. And do not people arrested. So section 6, paragraph K, second line, missing word. Layden began the discussion by saying the students were coming from an educational perspective and do not people arrested. I think he wants to say do not want people arrested.
Represent.
Sorry?
Represent.
It's not up to you. I'm sorry, do you want me to bring the minutes up?
Anyway, look at paragraph K. There's a missing word.
Do not want. Sorry. We do not have people arrested.
Page 2.
6K. Line 2. Okay. Oh, that's not it.
This is a different set of minutes, I guess.
You're there. 15.
You're in the 29th.
Let's see. I'm catching up.
Six K line two, Layden began. Second line to the bottom.
Yeah.
Right there.
Why is it out of the system?
Sorry?
Why is that?
It's in the minutes.
Oh, in the minutes.
Yeah, I think it's do not want.
It's in there.
There's a missing
one. I only see one K.
Section 6, Kate, you're not in the minutes, I don't think.
Look at page 2, bottom of page 2, two paragraphs up. It says A, board safety discussion resolution 1 hour.
Okay, I couldn't say
K. Well, it starts with K, but that's K, period,
oh.
Lady.
Oh, okay.
Was that under M?
Okay, any other changes?
And, oh, I see. It's all right then.
Ready to vote? All in favor? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9.
Just in time. Put your hand up.
We're voting on left meeting minutes. So I have 9-4. Any against? Abstaining? Passes. Okay, so the first item on our agenda is the CJC changes to the campus code of conduct. And I'm going to turn it over to Kate for these.
Yeah, if you could please move over, so.
Right, Charger. Most recent changes. I have to get the right window.
Maybe.
Here's the
more. Was that in better quality?
Is that feasible?
Yeah. Can you guys read that? Is it big enough? Do you need it bigger? Mary Beth says bigger.
I've got it in front of you.
There. Take it away.
Would you like me to follow up this report and read the entire thing, or just go down by the different sections? I'm going to propose, for the sake of time, we just go down by sections and read word for word.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Where the changes are coming in.
I'm going to go down, review what was discussed in the meeting minutes from CJC, and I invite anyone who is here to the present of the time to interject. Some of these changes are very simple wording, just to more explicitly say what the code is meant to say. It says, starting with section 3.2.8.1, the only thing that will be added is for the university, it will be specified in caps. All caps as it is listed on your sheet there. And this deals more with, this is an issue I'm not as familiar with, so I'm going to yield to Mary Beth.
This is actually just a scrivener's error. When the code was redrafted last year, it was reorganized in a way that made it much more easy to follow along. But the violations were divided into three sections. Sections primarily against persons, primarily against the university, and then sort of non-victim kind of thing. And inadvertently, there were some things that were listed as a violation against a person that might also apply to the university, such as theft. So this was the cleanest way to correct that, and it's not a substantive change. It's really just correcting a particular error.
Well, but does this mean that even more so the university can bring charges and then people have it?
Yeah, that was already possible, but yeah, but
not, not more so.
Right,
the same so. Right.
The same
so. If a crime against the university, a fairly tangible thing like theft of property or damage to a building, it has a little, pardon me, but I don't say it's fine. It has a bit of a ring of crimes against the state, which when China was accused of all the time of being criticized for getting out of China. This isn't in that way, right? So it wouldn't be a crime against the university that wouldn't be a crime if committed against a private person.
So the way that it's divided up, actually the theft is the very one that was not repeated. So the way that the discriminatory error, if it remains that way, stealing from the campus store would not be a violation, or stealing that beautiful TV would not be a violation.
I don't think we want to.
There's references to stuff like that, but it's not necessarily a code violation, because as I said, it's too abstract. How would you prove that? Yeah.
Any further questions? All right, moving on to section 3.2.A.1.D. Dealing with this act, if you look at the wording before the new text was added and including was removed, it said including such acts, and then it listed specific acts, and this caused student confusion because they thought it only pertained to those specific acts. So by adding certain language, adding a few more examples as well, saying any dangerous situation that creates physical or mental harm, it covers all areas that the section was intended to say. It's the meaning behind the section, but it's more explicitly revised wording.
Yeah, it was a point, point of clarification, that's all. When Barbara brought this forward, we were looking at things that the J's office sees very frequently, but for some reason students didn't follow that this was also an endangerment issue. So things like that you would think would be somewhat common sense, someone fighting or using a weapon in a fight or using their body as a weapon, that would typically be adjudicated under the endangering section, but students would come in and have no clarity that this would actually fall into there. So this is a point of clarification.
Yeah.
I don't understand the wording. For example, included but not limited to by such doesn't make much sense to me. And including but not limited to makes more sense than included. But
yeah, I don't know why that looks like another.
I didn't have that in my case.
And maybe there's supposed to be a comma after the word to, including
yes.
But not limited
yeah.
to.
Uh-huh. So what I'd suggest as an amendment is that this be including but not limited to comma omit by.
There should also be a space after the bracket time at the top.
The context of mental safety is a little kind of what is that? How do you endanger person's mental safety? Daring them?
Harassment, emotional abuse, hazing. We have a specific site for hazing. However, this is outside. Hazing applies to athletic clubs or groups or specific organizations, whereas the same act can be performed by an individual against an individual, and that goes to a mental distress issue.
It does seem pretty ambiguous that it would be room to include lots of activities because mental
Yeah, but if someone feels they may be physically threatened, I think it's...
Couldn't we just say threatening the bodily harm?
Well, that's already covered. In
yeah.
So this is 1G1, and then 1G2 includes threats or acts of
I think this dianopol, like they said, it's more like mental abuse. Kind of if you had like someone else scaring you, or you had a boyfriend that wasn't actually doing anything physical to you, and you're still abusing you mentally, they could give them the JIA.
Along with the stalking characters, yeah. Things that we, I mean, typically what we're seeing is harassment, stalking, Facebook bullying, those types of things where mental distress is elevated, but no physical harm has come to the individual. But it's clearly harassing.
Yeah, well, one of the things we've seen a lot this year, for some reason more than other years, has been, if you're familiar with the Wheel of Power and Control, where people, it's sort of the continuum of using domestic violence and things like that, where there might be sort of the mental abuse first, the minimizing and diminishing and, you know, stuff like that to gain control, and then it turns into physical violence later, and by the time it turns into physical violence, the victim is so diminished in his or her capacity to respond and so isolated from others. So that might be another example of what would fit in there.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that those are really bad processes, but I just wonder if they're against the law of cities and states, federal governments and so on, because they're still vague.
Is there a accepted definition of mental or mental safety in tort law or under Black's, you know, I mean, in other words, where this is, where people would go to interpret what this is usually meant under, you know, U.S. public law and New York law?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand it's ambiguous. If it conforms to legal norms, I don't have an issue, but I fully understand what you're saying. You could get, the uninitiated could get the kind of the, that wrong idea from exactly what is mental safety. I feel mentally unsafe.
Mm-hmm. I've heard an academic saying stress associated with an exam. I think there are mental safety issues going on right now on campus. Without language, use that language. And I don't think that's what it is. Touch on. So I can imagine this interpreted.
So one, and I'll just throw this out there. I mean, I personally understand where you're coming from, but another way to address it rather than have a specific definition of mental safety is to just take out physical or mental, so it's just dangerous situation for the safety of the individual, and then it can be interpreted by hearing voices.
I don't know if I actually like that idea of having a mental part. In there. And I don't know if it's better, I understand what you're saying about mental safety, if it's better to put it in a more negative aspect, that's physical or mental abuse or mental distress, whether that's more descriptive.
Well, I know there are bodies of law precedent for superior subordinate abuse, boss, employee, you know, all those things.
But
our concern is unless there's a connection in some common practice in the legal community where an attorney would almost universally understand what this means, then you tend to open yourself up for more rather than less scrutiny, and you don't need to keep caveating because there's probably more than physical and mental depending on how you want to peel back the onion. So it doesn't preclude that.
So could we use the language you gave, harassment, stalking?
Well, we have harassment in a different section. I was just going towards behaviors that do distress people in a mental format. But I think striking physical or mental is just leaving the safety of another individual in there is just fine. I think that addresses the issue.
Someone would like to make an amendment.
A motion to
amend. I would accept a amendment. Anyone?
Get rid of physical and mental, so a dangerous situation for the safety of another individual.
I'll accept that as changes.
Is
Right, there's no right mouse button, so it'll be tricky. Control, but remember to do it.
Everyone good so far? Moving on to section 3.4, point A, point 1, point A, point 7. This is one that was discussed at several meetings for CJC. From my understanding, the basic overview is that violation of probation was not specifically stated. It was covered under another section that didn't apply to it as well. The changes you see there are from CJC legal advice, Kenneth Fairmark in the law school. And I'll turn it over to anyone for CJC who would like to comment on that further.
I'll just say that this clarifies the procedure when there's a violation of probation. And the I don't think there's anybody here from the judicial code counselors. I'll just say that from the perspective of the accused student, what works out better about this system than the system that's been used is both students on probation and then have another violation. We would charge it as a violation of probation under noncompliance plus the new violation. So at the hearing, the hearing board would already know there's something else out there already, instead of having, you know, already come in with a completely clean slate. So this prevents that problem. It also makes the system a little bit simpler that the JA's office has the ability to say, hey, you know, you're in violation of probation, let's address it now. There's still the right to appeal it, but it can be addressed more simply. So that's why those changes were recommended.
We did put in a bit of checks and balances by having the offender be able to write to the university hearing board for a review of that penalty. That's in the last section.
First time that section, he does that at the end.
I think she's talking under its.
Oh,
number
am
two.
I in the wrong section?
There was another section, subpart E, but after discussing that with Ari, since it slightly covers a different subject, we decided to include that at the end.
Oh, okay. I was just going to ask you.
It's a very last section point.
Okay, cool.
Are we talking about two as well? Or just
yeah, I was talking about two.
Are we talking about two now? I just have a point to make about two.
Yeah.
Those are actually on two different pages.
We're
still talking about it.
Okay. Well, the last sentence, it seems to me, the last clause, the last sentence says, the offender made a petition and says, or it's a suspension or other penalty. Right. Above, it said that the offender may have additional penalties, including suspension or dismissal. It seems to me to mention suspension there is odd, and it might be useful just to say to review his, her, or its penalty, because if you're going to stipulate suspension, you might put dismissal as well, and any other.
Is that a motion?
I suggest it as a friendly amendment.
Yes.
Actually, off the record and officially, question for you, Mary Beth. If you read the last sentence of section 2 from the offender on,
yep,
that, I believe, is the part E that's included in the very last section.
I think it needs to be in both places.
Okay.
But this makes the part E, it just sort of makes you look for the part E.
Okay.
I think it needs to be in both places. But I think Marty is right, actually, that it's just any of the penalties imposed.
And I'm assuming that by it's, you're referring to a fraternity or an organization.
Yes. Student organization.
So Mary Beth, is that page 24E1?
Yeah. No, that this one, part 2, is
no, that you're referring to the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
I find that in a minute.
I have a correction for you. It should be notify the university registrar.
Oh.
Since I'm the one that handles those.
Is that number two?
Yeah.
Yes. You just need to add
university
registrar.
amendment? Does that sound friendly?
Can I say
that? Yeah, I find those friendly.
Instead of his, her, or its, can it just be the?
Under which part?
Number two, the offender may petition the university board in writing for review of the suspension or other penalty imposed.
We're taking out, aren't we?
Suspension could be the, right?
The penalty.
So it's in that sentence sounds like somebody that doesn't identify as a he or a she.
The penalty.
Although that part may be true if that's not what you mean.
I'll show that.
No, the penalty is
more. There we go.
More.
Yeah. It reads better.
The other thing is that number two there is not part of 3481A7.
It's under part seven. Mm-hmm.
It's under on page 35 under security compliance.
Well, seven is under.
Oh yeah, yeah. So it's seven. Okay, so there's just like a gap. So seven is on page 33, and then this two is under.
Don't change anything.
Yeah, it's just a different part of that same. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's actually why we split up E.
I get it.
Probably should have done the same for two. Any other comments, questions? Did you got all the changes, Mark?
I believe so. All
right. So moving on to section 3.2.B. One of the more simple changes to explain. Temporary protective protection directive is a specific legal term, and from my understanding, it's caused confusion. Students don't necessarily understand what that means.
The old code had temporary order protection, which was one that was a specific legal term, and people thought that if they violated, we issued one, they violated it, they'd be arrested, and we don't have that capacity under our system. So we came up with this temporary protection directive instead, and it blew it up a lot of time. So the no contact directive is just easier to say. People seem to understand it better. Casey said that people tend to accept it better. Like, oh yeah, I don't want contact, sure. So it's just, you know, more simple language, simple English, not substantive change.
I like it because it sort of says what it means. That's what it means. And the other one it almost sounds like it's more for the victim.
Yeah.
The victim has something.
Yeah.
Temporary.
Yeah.
Before I can't wait for it to touch.
And
yeah, I like it.
It needs a hyphen, though.
Oh, good point.
Kevin had, before we voted, Kevin had suggested we make it no hyphen contact directive.
I'm sorry, what was the
no space or no hyphen contact?
And all the wording that near the current code, the only thing changed is
on all of them?
Yeah.
Title listed.
Right.
Time six.
So all of them to no hyphen contact, right?
Right. Time 6, yes.
There's no contact include phone calls, email.
Yeah. It's very explicitly written in the directive given, so.
Updated periodically as new
technology. Any further questions or comments? All right, moving on to section 3.4.A.1.C. The only words we're going to add here are or discriminate against, just because the simple definition of harass and discriminate are two different things. This was actually voted on weeks ago in CJC, but I feel it could have been applicable to the Chi Alpha situation, since that was more discrimination issue instead of harassment. So then we had to explain that early enough. Questions, comments?
Is there a practical problem with that particular case that since this language wouldn't have been in question?
Yeah, there's nothing we can do about that case, but if that would happen. Sorry, can you clarify if that would happen in the future? Would that be a direct violation of the campus code of conduct, or would that just be an investigation? So the policy 6.4 that is incorporated by this code section includes harassment against or discrimination against a person who's based on their protected class status. This code section used to be just sexual harassment, but now it includes all the different kinds of protected classes. And what we realized when we incorporated 6.4 last year is that we incorporated harassment, but we didn't incorporate the discrimination part of 6.4. And some of us were a little surprised and horrified that we hadn't caught before that the code didn't prohibit discrimination. So
it's like prohibiting part of it. It's prohibiting behavior based on half of a policy that's already in effect. So you have a policy violation and not a code violation.
And just a follow-up question to that. Are both religious status and sexual orientation considered under the protected class? Policy 6.4. I believe they both are. Does anybody know 6.4? I believe they both are. Religious one.
Policy, it should be a definition under policy.
I can look that up for you and let you know. I'm pretty sure they're both affected. I'm not commenting about the specific case. I would need to do a thorough investigation to say whether or not it would be discrimination. But if we allowed or anybody to come to us, say, you know, you've got a discrimination, we would allow us for an investigation instead of to say the code doesn't cover discrimination, which is how it is right now, and that's what happened in the other situation. I can't.
This is going to 6.4.
This is according to engaging in any form of prohibited discrimination or protected status. In parentheses included sexual harassment. I expect these individuals also to refrain from committing acts of bias within the university's jurisdiction. It doesn't specifically list them all up.
It does. The definition section. It's bias to be against religion, gender expression, identity, veteran status. It's very comprehensive list. And it mentions number 2 that you did.
So both religion
and religious expression. I'm going to go so far as to divide religion and religious expression, I think. Or I don't, can't remember exact words, but.
The protected class is still kind of up in the air. What would happen? We need to be dealt with on a case by case basis. I used to practice civil rights law, and we would have conflicts, say, between somebody with a disability that needed to have a dog, and then somebody with a disability that was allergic to dogs, and their neighbors then have you involved with conflicts. So, you know, those kinds of things need to be handled on a case by case basis to make sure that everybody's rights are protected.
In the last line of bias, hate crime.
Yeah, it's under bias, hate crime, or bias.
I had a question for Mary Beth. It's more of a general question in the scope of the code. I probably should know. There's a breach to the policy. Would that cover? I know we keep using this case, which I know that your office isn't dealing with right now, but. Would it pertain to groups that are receiving Cornell institutional funding, or just Cornell registered groups, or just groups on campus? You know, does the code cover everything?
So I'd have to double check the definition in here in the code about student organizations. But I think student organizations are defined pretty broadly in the code, and I can look that up for you later, Ryan.
Okay, great.
Any further comments, questions?
I just have to say I can't believe we didn't catch this.
All right, moving on to section 2.2.A.3.D. The words marijuana or any will be added. And for this explanation, I will yield the floor to Kathy's owner.
Basically, we've been writing marijuana under this section anyway. We've been adjudicating that under this section anyway. Again, we butt up against the legal terminology of controlled substance. Marijuana is sometimes held separate, and it only gets a controlled substance in a certain quantity. But it's still a violation of the law to possess small amounts. So it's a point of clarification, much like the one we had brought up before, so the students understand that marijuana is a controlled substance and that it's something that they could be in violation of the code for.
Any questions?
some of the things that we were looking at this year were to just make sure that we have good notice. You know, if you think to yourself as a first year student coming in, and you read that section, it's like, oh, what? I can smoke weed. You know, I can't prove it. So we're looking for things like that just to make sure we're getting really good notice.
Dorm lawyers. Oh, no, that's not covered.
What's the law on nicotine?
Is it not considered a...
So, I mean, there's an age.
Right. And they just lowered it, didn't they? Right, but that's, it doesn't refer to nicotine, it refers to tobacco.
Tobacco.
So...
I've got a couple of questions. Yeah. I have a good question. What happens if, I know a lot of states are considering thinking about legalizing marijuana. Then would you take this out?
Forward as a proposal, I would assume. Yeah. It doesn't need to be not more restrictive within the code, but less or matching.
Some states, there are certain ones that are legal.
Right. For medicinal use for some people.
And I know that New York is considering medicinal use. So it would be, again, it would be under, categorically, you would have to be possessing it under a doctor's prescription. So there would still be the issues like you would have with Adderall, Ritalin, other controlled substances that we have on campus. So controlled substances does not necessarily mean illegal substances. Mm-hmm. So just the manner in which they're used is illegal.
Yeah, I just wanted to add these pretty much the same thing. And also more high, especially like with a medical marijuana type case. Like if New York does change that law, like there has been talked about, and a student comes here with a prescription for medical marijuana, I feel like there should be some more leeway in that, and not in the fact we'll have to address it then. I think there should be something that says this will be addressed if that happens.
Well, we can't do that for everything. We could do the same thing with drinking age, and we could do the same thing for other things.
If you read the paragraph here, I think you're careful. It says to unlawfully possess marijuana as defined by state or federal law. So if they're in compliance with state and federal law, they're in compliance with this statement.
Right. So it does address it in that.
So if the law of New York changes, this does not need to change. They're covered.
Yep.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, moving on to section 3.2.8.3.b. The section we debated also, I believe, for several meetings in CJC, and the entire section was reworded. Currently, the section that is now in place mirrors New York State law.
It's usually a good thing. Why are we changing that?
And the new section was added, I believe, because there were some issues involving what happens when a parent gives the child alcohol.
There's a big misunderstanding for sub one. They seem to think that the parent could give it to them, they could travel 4,000 or 5,000 miles with their alcohol, show up at the dorm, and just because mom or dad gave it to them. It's not actually how the law is written. The law is written that the parent has to be there in direct supervision of the parent when the parent gives the alcohol. So we didn't write that all in the code. So we just, rather than trying to pull the agency law and plunk it in here, we try to give clarity to the section, make it readable, understandable, where you're violating the law, where you're not violating the law.
And again, to try and get better notice, because students were telling us things like, well, I put it down quickly and then I wasn't in possession, and it was getting into this hair splitting stuff, and it's like, no, you're not supposed to drink. That this just provides clarity. And it also mirrors the language that we just talked about with respect to drugs, and that seems that has that kind of parallel language seems to make sense to the book on people's feet.
One question for clarification. At many campuses, Elmira, Binghamton, for instance, if you have a multi-person dorm room and an RA comes in and a person has alcohol, their policy is a problem for one, is a problem for all. So if there's three 20-year-olds in the room and one has a beer, all three get written up and go through the campus process. What is Cornell's policy?
There's two different policies. There's a housing policy, which addresses that issue. The house rules make it a violation of house rules to be in a room with someone who's remember how important.
In the presence of alcohol.
I mean, you guys are better. We don't write for that.
Okay, so that's not, this.
No, this is the code.
And the scenario you just described, if one person has one beer, only that person.
Right.
Because that's the person with the intent to consume.
Right. If they're 21, they can have their beer.
Okay.
Well, that doesn't mean
yeah, well, that's a different
question. That's just so much. Not for the
but, right now. But, you know, if the one roommate is a partner and the other roommate's off in his room, the second person in his room is not going to
want to
help
counsel
under
the
RG. We have a question.
So, sorry, I don't know if perhaps this is some of these issues brought up PJC, but first time looking at this, but has there any ground of discussion in effect on harm reduction at all? Or, just to respond to some comments, it seems appropriate and logical to mirror state, federal law, talking about. But also, I think, given we are sort of private collegiate environments, we also have other priorities. You know, we have a certain demographic, a certain scope. And, so there are priorities such as harm reduction and cultural sensitivity, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know, were any of these addressed at the CJC level?
We didn't talk about it at CJC, Ryan, but that's something that I always think about because I really believe in the harm reduction approach. And I think one of the things that I've learned from my colleagues at Gannett is that sending clear and consistent messages is a really important thing. And I believe in it anyway, just because we want to be transparent. And one of the frustrating things about the former section is that it's not clear and it's not transparent. So from a harm reduction approach, if we're being clear and transparent, then people can make their choices about, am I going to drink or not, and they're not going to get into the, someone told me that, these are the ways to get out of it. No, everybody makes their own choices.
We have the MAP protocol, the medical amnesty protocol, which addresses those concerns. Removing it from the code because one addresses one thing and harm reduction is really more under a different kind of umbrella. But we certainly have a policy of acting under the auspices of harm reduction.
Yeah. And actually, I think this strengthens the method also.
And there was an example brought up actually in the CJP, just looking at the minutes now. Rachel Dorr, an intendant, who was actually planning on being here but couldn't make it the last minute, she used the example of, say I had a friend who didn't drink and she was at a party and someone handed her a drink and the cops came in at that exact moment, she'd still be prosecuted. And Murray Beth's explanation was under both rules she could be. So it doesn't really change anything as far as that aspect.
Either she could be or she might be found not in violation, based on a particular thing. Because it doesn't really change who's going to be found in violation, it just clarifies it.
I think if you remove alcohol and you insert the word drugs, everybody gets it. But once you put alcohol in there, somehow it becomes okay. So, if you have pot and you hand it to me and say, hey, hold my stash, and somebody comes in, I'm the one that's going to get charged. I'm holding it. And this guy's going to go, I don't even know her. So, that's
true.
But when you talk about alcohol, that's just a different hole in your beer. You really have to look at it in kind of the same context. Illegal to possess it under a certain age. There's a rationale behind why it's unlawful. And therefore, if you're under 21, don't hold your friend's beer. Put it on the ground.
Alexander. I'd like to talk about the word unlawfully at the very beginning. To me, that means that in order to be convicted of this statute, you have to go through a lawful procedure. And I'm asking what evidentiary standard does the JA have to use in order to convict under this statute if, let's just say the offender contends that their possession was lawful, whether it means that they were not intending to consume, they were in some way legally possessing the control or the alcohol. How does the JA prove that they were unlawfully possessing that alcohol without a jury process?
Okay, well, again, unlawful mimics the law, and that's the way it's been adjudicated all the way through. We just wasn't present in the prior statement, but unlawful is the actual statute is unlawful possession of alcohol. It's not illegal possession. It's unlawful.
Okay.
So that's the New York state law. And this just mimics, again, the language. Their burden of proof is the same as all the other
clear and convincing.
Clear and convincing.
So it's less than the proof beyond a reasonable doubt that's required in the criminal justice system, but it's more, it's actually a high standard for it.
More, above more likely than not.
Right, yes. Right.
Any other questions?
Party done.
So does that mean that as a part of an official university course is lawful?
Correct, that's lawful. That's addressed in ABC law.
Or doing lab work.
Right.
Yeah.
Or for people who have it as a sacramental thing in their religion.
Okay. Anything else? No objections? All right, moving on to section.
We'll see that amendment next.
Okay, section 3.3.E.2. This would require evidence to be presented before it goes to hearing to the chair. I believe it says a time limit.
Three
business days. And I'll let there be one left.
So currently, the only information that has to be exchanged between the JA and the accused student prior to hearing is a witness list and any statements, any written statements that have been provided by the witnesses. And this has proved problematic for a couple of reasons. One is from a logistical point of view at the hearings themselves. It takes a long time to, you know, sort of pass out the stack of exhibits, to do it one at a time, get them admitted through the various witnesses. The second problem, and this is probably even more important, is that it created an unfairness, particularly for the accused students, where you know, the JA's office was following the procedures that were outlined and didn't expand the discovery, and then the student hadn't had an opportunity to view the exhibit in advance. And we really want to expand that. That's a suggestion of the hearing board and hearing board chairs, and we absolutely embrace it. It's we want to be as fair as we can and make sure that people are on as much notice as possible. So this would just expand the information that everybody has before a hearing.
So the students would know 3 days in advance that you actually have pictures of them from the security camera drinking that alcohol.
Yeah.
When they say I didn't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
From the satellite.
Are you? Does the words in the second sentence for his or ruling belong in advance to be made to the chair for his or her ruling in advance of the hearing? In other words, should they be moved to?
Yes.
Okay. So I recommend you move the words for his or her ruling to after the word of the clause to the chair.
Okay.
In other words, the ruling should take place in advance of the hearing.
Okay.
The other question is, when is there any, this isn't related to what's written there, but is there any thought about how soon before the ruling the chair should rule on objections?
You know, we intentionally didn't, this wasn't discussed at CJC, but when I was drafting it, I intentionally didn't include that because we don't want to still limit the chair. You know, if right now we've got male chairs, if the chair says, I just don't have time to get to this until right before the hearing, I don't want to put an extra burden on that volunteer who's. And maybe there'll be an objection that the accused student has that he or she doesn't think about it until right before. So I think that we need to have some flexibility there and, you know, just work with reasonableness.
Okay. And chair should be initial cap.
I thought we did more than initial cap.
Okay. I'll prefer the cap.
Okay. I'm not sure, Captain.
I think the implication of Catholic chair is different than wooden chair.
Oof.
Oh. That official amendment? Is that grammatically correct?
Should it say hearing board chair? Because that's what it says in the paragraph.
You know what? You don't have just hearing board chair. You also have a review board chair.
Yeah.
So,
yes,
so if you qualified it at all, it would be judicial board chair.
I think chair
alone
is fine. But it's great.
Okay.
Any other comments? going on through section 3.2.A.3.1 and 4.3.E.3.B.6.C. We group this together because these are corresponding points. They just happen to appear in different sections of the code. And I'm going to let, before I give my opinion on this, I'd like Mary Beth to explain.
So one of the things that is really good about the campus disciplinary system is that we've got a lot of rights and protections for the people within the system. So, and last year when you all were reviewing the code, it was definitely decided that we wanted to have those sort of mirrored to the legal system. The problem has been that there are times when we have certain things that protect a few students but don't necessarily provide the balance for either the victims or the community trying to prove a case. And one of them is this ability to have somebody testify. And that also can be a problem for a few students if they know that there's a person out there who can exonerate them and that person refuses to testify. So this code change, well, I was reluctant to bring it forward because of wanting to make sure that we feel educational and that we have a system that's not too legalistic. At the same time, it felt necessary to make sure that whether it's the JA's office or whether it's the accused student, that they can get the help they need to provide all the information necessary for the hearing board to make a fair decision. There was a concern in our discussions, and I remember Kathleen spoke really eloquently about it, that we don't want to be in a position where we're forcing a complainant to say who's been traumatized by an action to have to testify and go forward when he or she really, it would just re-victimize that person. So we came up with this system where the hearing board chair could make the determination and balance the interests of the parties and the situation to determine, is this the case to have the witness come forward? And this is the compromise that everybody felt comfortable with.
My one question is this, which you can correct me if I'm wrong at any point in this, is that in outside of Cornell, if this was a civil suit, it would take the act of a subpoena,
yes.
Is that correct? And I feel that the connotation attached to a subpoena requiring someone to testify is very strong. And so leaving sort of that ambiguity there, I have some issues with, some questions. I don't know how the rest of you feel if you could speak to that, but that was just one point that I had some concerns about.
I have the same concerns if say, the person they could testify for against is a girlfriend or visiting, in other words, not a Cornell student.
Right.
How do you compel somebody that the university has no jurisdiction authority over?
Couldn't. It would only apply to members of the Cornell community. And the difference between the subpoena in a civil or criminal action versus what we'll be looking at here, I believe this is how it works. I haven't had subpoena many people in my legal practice, but at that time, the attorney would just say, I want to subpoena this person. It didn't have to be this balancing act for the sort of equivalent the judge would do for us. So.
I want to muddy this up a little bit. And I unfortunately, I don't have what it takes to clarify what I want to muddy. To order the witness to testify, I like something as long as it doesn't harm the witness's mental safety.
Well, and I think that's
but I don't have the right word.
I think that's what the hearing board chair would have to, weigh that, and the witness would have the ability to say to the chair. But I mean, I can give you.
I'd feel better if it was written.
Yeah.
But it is.
It is
because the hearing board chair shall, in his or her sole discretion, grant or deny the request based on the balance of equities for the witness. I think that covers what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's looking out for the best interest of the witness.
I'm just curious, who is the hearing board chair? Whose interests are they representing?
They are a senior member of faculty. They're a senior member of faculty, and they're independent of, and they wanted specifically to have it
to see him find his tenure, so that's not something to worry about losing his or her job. Currently, the chairs are George Hayden, who's a professor in the law school, and Brian Shavitt, who's a professor in Cal. And they've been both doing it for quite some time.
And they're non-voting, so it's not like their decisions will impact any of the decision of the board itself.
An objective of third parties.
Yeah, really.
I mean, one of the things that is the code changes we've done is to put a little bit more, have them be a little bit more active, and it's been really, really helpful. The ways that you think I've had them participate more. I get things more.
I was absent from this, this meeting, which was voted on, and you said that there was a consensus among the committee.
Yeah, I think I don't know what the vote was.
Yeah, we discussed it for a long time, but around a lot of the issues that are being brought forward here, and the number of cases that just kind of fizzle because somebody doesn't show up, or you know, they want to bring a case, they go through everybody's time, they report it to the police, they bring it to the JA, they do an initial meeting, and then they just kind of drop. It's a lot of time and investment, and you get a hearing set up and people just don't show up, and people are there until midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning trying to adjudicate a case that could be easily resolved if this person would have just shown up.
And
so some of it's just trying to get things moving along too.
Well, now this isn't the witness then, it's an accuser.
Witness.
Yes, I know, but in the case you just discussed, it's somebody who didn't show up who had accused someone else.
No, it could be a testifying witness that would clarify the issue. I mean, you see what I'm saying? If you've got two people, one accusing the other, and no other substantive evidence but other than a witness who doesn't show up, you go on for hours debating whether or not this event actually happened, whereas if one or the other side could produce a witness and the person actually shows up and testifies.
An example that happened this year was there was a sexual assault that was overheard by a roommate, and the roommate refused to come to the hearing. Luckily, in that case, there was criminal conviction, so we were able to save on that. But had there not been the criminal conviction, we would have a rapist.
I have a vocabulary question. What does equity and equities mean in this case?
Balance of equities.
Making sure you're saying all things are fair.
Yeah, so I wonder if we could change it based on the balance, on balancing the interests of the witness.
Well, I don't think the interest is...
I think that's clear.
Maybe fairness would be clear.
Fairness would be... So much ambiguity is tied to what's fair. I feel, I mean, life's not fair in general. So
So balancing the interests of everybody is saying that the hearing board.
Well, I'm objecting to that because I don't think interest is clear either, because you don't want to change.
Clearly, the interest of the accused and the interest of the victim are going to be very different.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's the mental safety interest that I'm thinking of.
And understand, of course, you get the 50-50 of these issues, it becomes the eye of the, the person and where they would default.
So, with this wording, too?
Yes.
I would feel like equity captures both interest and fairness in one word.
And it involves a balance.
It conforms to mostly equities.
There seems to be a lot of availment, so I'm not going to accept it firmly offhand unless someone else would like to comment. Okay, we'll keep the wording as it is.
One, should non-testifying be hyphenated?
Where are
you?
Where the red underline is.
The red underline.
Oh, that's not even a proposed change. That's
current standing code, pre-existing.
Okay, but shouldn't it be hyphenated?
If you would like to bold it and...
Nick, just right-clicking and seeing what Microsoft Word says.
Just right-clicking.
I don't understand how
hyphenation is. The keyboard is going to say it's not a word whatsoever.
If it says that, then it's probably just fine.
Normal.
Microsoft Word doesn't know everything.
What?
You
can see what
Equity is. Not just because I'm spelling out a word in English dictionary. That's why it's underlined. So it should be.
Certainly.
By a complaint or victim not testifying.
Could you right click on
that? Not.
Would be the correct.
Yeah. Can we, since we're here and working on that, can we correct that, please?
Would you like to? If you'll make a friendly amendment on.
I would like to recommend we change that to by not testify, by a.
Complaining or victim not testifying.
You do need a hyphen?
I have the words asking for it.
Okay. Motion for a hyphen. Friendly.
Friendly.
Thank you.
Woo!
Thanks, Kathy.
I don't have
it. Any other comments? This is actually the second or third copy of wording that has gone through CJC regarding this exact issue. I remember around February 17th, we passed a different set of wording.
Which one?
That's not included in here.
Oh.
Just speaking to the issue. This has been brought up, I believe, at every CJC meeting this semester.
What, not testifying, I think?
No, it was witness testimony.
Oh, right. Yeah, we have had.
And our legal advisor keeps coming back with new advice. So if anyone has any further questions or comments, I would like to speak now.
Well, so what were the arguments against this?
It's just
pretty
they
much
were all
already said.
They all pretty much said the same thing. The different versions of wording that's supposed to be the most clear. The main issue I would say was the question wasn't too heavily contradicted. It's largely based on emotional state, and as James brought up, if it, like for example, if it was your girlfriend, if you want to testify against her, and it becomes a very sticky issue, but as Mary has shown, in for a case of sexual assault, sometimes it can be overridden.
I would think it would have to be pretty much standard. I mean, it's a pretty serious case. I think that a run-of-the-mill alcohol case would not be the same.
And again, we put in the hearing board chair, too, to sort of as a check and balance on this.
What's the punishment for a person who uses? It's a violation. If you remember, it can't be used what can happen to a non-compliant.
You know,
if the lawyer goes out, you must testify.
The typical sanctions in general are, you know, things like community service or writing a reflection paper and things like that.
Not much. I'm thinking about your case of a roommate who can testify, which is hard to understand.
I think the main idea here is to give the hearing board chair some language that he can use, saying this is a co-recommendation that you have to appear to make this hearing possible. We're not as interested in the violations as making the witness participate if it's important to the case. And that's why the hearing board chair is the check and balance.
Do you need a violation to be entered in the case?
I believe there's a specific section of the code dedicated to non-compliance. So I can't speak as to what section specifically would be tried under, but from the sounds that it would be non-compliance.
Well, the part right here is a new code section, but Kevin, you weren't sure that part is in Kevin?
Which one?
The part that says refuse to participate without a substantial reason. And that's a new section that would be added in on like page 18. But I think that you had some concerns.
I was just trying to correlate all the documents like a half hour before this meeting. Uh-huh. So can I see that for just a minute?
Yeah. I am
just to make sure we actually voted on.
I thought that that both of the sections were voted on at the same time. But even if we don't have that section, Kate is absolutely right that we can just do it under non-compliance with that extra stuff. I think what's better about this is that it talks about the substantial reason. But, as I said, my recollection is that we voted on both, or you guys voted on both at the same time.
Okay, unless anyone has any amendments they'd like to make, I'm going to take it as okay and move on. We're almost done. Section 2.4.C.3, the pool of board members. This issue was brought up by Mayor Best because there have been some people who were selected for the hearing review board who have not been fulfilling their duties. And so this would give it the discretion of the chair to remove them in such a case.
But not to appoint replacements.
No, that's still you guys.
Anyone have issues with this? Wording good? Okay, moving on then to section 3.3.8.1. So this is actually mirroring a previous section that we moved past. Mm-hmm. Mary Beth, you can speak to this better since.
So remember before we talked about the probation change and the way to go about dealing with probation violations, this just clarifies that if the JA's office imposes a suspension or other penalty for a probation violation, that the accused person can ask for a hearing to make sure that we're not being arbitrary and capricious. Just another check and balance.
Can we change that wording?
Yeah, I did.
To
friendly.
Yeah, friendly.
Yeah.
Doesn't need suspension, it could be just a penalty.
Yeah.
Don't roll around. Any other issues?
Just a grammar thing. Prescribed penalty or remedy or for the violation.
For non-compliance or for a violation of probation.
Okay.
So I don't know if they need to be a comma or something to make that work.
Yeah.
It would help.
Yeah.
Penalty, comma, remedy, comma, or violation.
Well, it's
non-compliance
or remedy.
Penalty or remedy, comma, or for violation.
Or for what? There
we are.
Well,
I have one more friendly amendment.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, 3.2.A, you said dot one, I confirmed it should be dot one, but you listed it to stay one.
I'll put that.
I didn't understand that one. 3.2.A
at the top.
You got to go all the way, just go all the way to the top.
Right,
there's a dot right there. 3.2.A, dot one.
Okay, specifically with the last section, does anyone have any issues with that?
No.
Ready to move on? Okay, anyone have any other issues with this little package?
Let's call it.
You guys ready?
All ready?
Let's call it.
All in favor?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Opposed? And abstentions? So it passes 12-0-0.
Yes.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Can you hang up for a few minutes? It's a resolution for May, but it's okay. The next resolution that I have is for the extension of the JA's term. And it states, whereas the charter of the university states, in the article, and it goes on, and whereas the president has forwarded a letter to the chair, me, asking that the Mary Beth, I sent it to her.
I've seen it in writing. Yeah.
And now for there be resolved that the UA confirms the recommendation of the president to extend to an additional term of 2 years to the current JA. And I so move. Can I have a second? Seconded by Kate.
I think some members would. Yes,
please. Sorry, I was at the wrong meeting. It happens to everybody, right?
Sorry, you can't come back in. You've got to go look for a job.
So is it moved in second?
It's moved in second. Are we ready to vote now? All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Any opposed? Any abstentions? It passes 12-0-0. Okay.
Better
wait. Do you want to come back?
You're the president. Come on, go get it.
And very quickly, you want
to? Yeah. I just wanted to commend the Cogent Judicial Committee for a phenomenal year of work that they've done. They still have some unfinished business. We're still working on our judicial appointment interviews, which we will send to you over the summer, hopefully. But and Mary Beth has been particularly helpful to us, as always. But the Cogent Judicial Committee as a whole has just done a phenomenal job on your behalf.
Before Kathleen leaves, if I could also just say that Kathleen has been on the Cogent Judicial Committee for, I think, 25 years and is going to be retiring here. And we just want to offer such a debt of gratitude to lead us through and really care about the various changes we've made. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. Okay, let's move on to...
Given that she's been on for so long, do we have some, can we make some resolutions?
We totally should. I mean, she's really been...
Do we have that? Can we do that?
Sure.
We're not going to
do whatever.
Have a good one.
Do we need to vote on that?
I don't think those are parliamentary.
It has to be right now.
We can send a letter of commendation.
Okay.
To the long-time chair.
Everybody in agreement for that?
Yeoman service.
Okay.
All right. We'll draft and send the executive committee will sign on behalf
of the group.
Of the group.
Okay.
Before May 1st.
Yes, sir. All right, next is the presentation on the College Town Urban Plan and Design Guidelines.
Before we start, I move to extend the meeting by how long do people think?
Hopefully not longer than 10 15 minutes.
Move to extend to 6:15.
Second.
All in favor? I think that's unanimous. Did you vote?
Anyway.
11 to, are you opposed or abstaining?
Is that enough time?
Ryan just said it was.
We can
re-extend it. We can re-extend it if we need to. Okay, that's unanimous. You can come over here.
Mr. President, I have two departments.
Okay.
I've given my opinions to Professor Ryan, but is there an issue on proxy? Is there an issue with that?
There is no proxy.
Very good. I'm in favor of it.
I don't think so.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for reminding me about that question.
The same week I'm going
to get your pump with
the sunset. Is that going to be a violation? Well, she's over
21, so.
Getting right on. I think we'll have Svante and Ed, who will introduce himself. Well, you all know Ed. Svante will introduce himself quickly in a very brief manner, go over the plan. Hopefully you were able to read the outline of the plan that Ed sent out last night. But in terms of
Well, you know what? I'll let you guys introduce the plan, and then I'll discuss the resolution and the, I guess, proposed university response or role, and then we'll show the questions and go from there.
Okay, so I could start. My name is Fonte Myrick. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the representative of the Fourth Ward of Common Council. I'm also a senior in the Ag School. The plan, in a nutshell, I mean, you guys probably noticed that this planning process started about 3 years ago. With one committee that transformed into another committee that transformed into another committee, as things usually do. About a year and a half ago, we secured funds, $90,000 from the university and $90,000 from the city, to hire a consultant, an urban design consultant, to put together a plan for the college to move. Really, the catalyst for this whole process has been an increase in development and an increase in undesirable development in College Town. A couple of proposed and actual projects in College Town in the past 3 or 4 years that have really struck a lot in the neighborhood in the wrong way, and I think an underlying need to improve the quality of the housing stock and the quantity of the housing stock. You know, the fact that there's such a stranglehold on real estate in College Town, we felt has repercussions throughout the city in terms of price and quality and availability of rental housing. It's a very dense neighborhood right there in College Town. The study area that we looked at, it was about 5,000 people. 97% of those are renters, and approximately the same percentage are students. We found that land values in that area are between $6 and $10 million per acre. So very, very expensive. I mean, that's analogous to downtown Boston and San Diego. That's because it's such a captive. You know, students don't want to live too much further out. They're willing to pay $600 a month, $1,000 a month, $12,000 a month to live in a closet, so you can really build some high value real estate there. But with the current zoning, we found that people were building odd, large, blocky buildings in order to make a profit, right? Because the only way that they would make a building, they would build a building and turn a profit is if they did this. They had to consolidate all this land at $6 to $10 million an acre. It's very expensive, not to mention the property taxes that you pay on something. Worth that much. So what this plan does is, first, it changes the urban design guidelines. Right? So this changes, it dictates actually what a building has to look like. It is far more in-depth than just simply saying what the zoning currently says is you can only be this tall, you can only be this wide, and everything else is up to you. But the new design guidelines will dictate things like form, materials, things like what kind of roofs you have on a house. A lot of things just aesthetically will make College Town much more pleasing, but this will also reduce the rate of return that you can get on your investment, right? Because you're sacrificing space for aesthetics. So at the same time, we increase the zoning to allow for taller buildings in some areas, wider buildings that take up a larger footprint in most areas, and we're hoping that the two will offset each other, that we can get attractive buildings in College Town once again, but we can also increase the quality and the quantity of housing stock and concentrate really supply where there is such a high demand.
And one of the other issues I'll just tack on is, you know, the neighborhoods flank College Town, which are very important to those residents, to everybody in Ithaca. And right now, because there's such a limited supply and there's more demand than there's supply, there's a very legitimate concern that students are spreading into those neighborhoods. And what were single-family homes, single-family neighborhoods, are being, the prices of those properties are rising because people are coming in, buying those houses, carving them up into rental units, and then renting them to students. And that's an undesirable thing on all accounts. Students would rather live in what's defined as College Town rather than moving into these other single-family neighborhoods. And so this is another issue that, you know, why to increase the supply in College Town proper is to relieve the pressures and protect the.
And then just before we go on to the resolution, to comment quickly on the student role that has student role in this process thus far, and the procedure that this plan has, well, deviated from. I don't know how many years, I guess it is at this point now, that this process started, and Goody Clancy, the third-party consulting firm that, like any consulting model, I suppose, takes into account all stakeholders in a way that is as equitable as possible. College Town, the city of Ithaca happens to be majority population, happens to be students, and College Town is 97% student residents. So this, and that doesn't necessarily represent the city council, the elected officials. So, but anyway, bringing in this third-party consulting firm, taking into account all the stakeholders in a way that was equitable, they came up with this plan. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the fundamentals of this plan are density in the core of college town, which is more aligned with sustainability principles and which is more aligned with the supply and demand problems that even more so now that Cornell will be accepting more students, you know, there needs to be more supply. And then, of course, preservation of communities. Students are sprawling out more and more because of the lack of supply in the core and the high prices in the core. So the more supply will alleviate the demand. But now, after this plan was proposed to the city, it's sort of, at least from an outsider's perspective, not someone on the council, it's been not only hitting roadblocks, but, I mean, it's being almost ignored by many of the city council members. And it is because it is taking into account a very important stakeholder, students and Cornell, students live in College Town. And so that, I think, there was a lot of excitement over this plan and over these new initiatives. And then after seeing it sort of almost ignored, after $187, after all of these principles and values have been outlined out, they're very much still deviating from this process. And so undergraduates, the student assembly, and other graduate students and others are really looking to send a message and throw support behind these principles, these goals, which is the Goody Clancy plan. We've been working a lot with Office of University Government and Community Relations, excuse me. I know my Goody, John Gutenberger, I guess. Gutenberg. You know, he's been to a lot of these joint community university meetings, as are a lot of SA members, and you know, a lot of questions are, well, what does Cornell think, and well, what is Cornell going to do? Well, we did fund the money, but I know Cornell is always careful about overextending its boundaries. You know, they don't want to tell the city what to do, and they want to allow the processes that be govern the city. But I think at this point in time, it is appropriate to at least send some sort of unified and coherent message. And I think that resolution does this, and so does the Office of Government and Community Relations. And no one asked, well, all right, here's the assembly system. What can we do besides going to these meetings and going to as many city council meetings as we can? And supporting Savante, the one and only student on the council, this was something else that was suggested. So I know, the plan is incredibly complex and has a lot of pages and a lot of different issues, and I know the city won't adopt everything to a T, but I think what the spirit of this resolution, it focuses on the fundamentals of the plan: density in the core, sustainability, increasing the quality of the housing for undergraduates, given that College Town is South Campus, and it really is, amongst other things it said.
Does anybody have any questions? I mean, I know I said what was a short summary of this. There's a lot of detail. Do you have any questions about that?
I always wondered why the city allowed really ugly cinder block buildings to go up in College Town. Did they not have the power to require something better looking?
Yeah, this is the frustrating part of it. The process in the past, and actually even after this planning process, we adopt a new plan, this is still what's going to happen in the rest of the city, is that we have a planning board, right? And you can bring your plan to the planning board, you bring your blueprints and your design, and as long as it fits under the height limit and the lot size, the lot coverage, there's nothing that the planning board can mandate you to do. So we had a lot of meetings where we're like, this is very ugly, we wish you wouldn't do this, and could you pick a different material, and could you put a pitched roof on it and some more windows, and could you put something on the ground floor? And the developer would just like nod their head and then leave and build the building that they wanted to build anyway. So it's very, very frustrating. And I think that's going to be one of the strongest things to come out of this. And if it's successful in College Town, we may see it. The city's undergoing a comprehensive planning process right now, similar to the one that the university just did. If it works in College Town, I think we'll see it adopted in the whole city.
It's one of the neat things about this plan, actually, is right now, as it sits, it's just like Savante said, you know, like you build the spot coverage, you build this height, that's what you get, and then you get to the next zone, right? And it drops down in height significantly. But this plan, the consultant took a bigger concept and said, okay, what do you want it to look like when you're walking down the street? So instead of dropping down drastically, you now make these transitions of this where, you know, you go from one height to a little bit less of a height to a little bit less height, and in between there, like in the core where in the plan it proposes, you know, 90 feet, and then the next zone it could be 60 feet. It's not just a 60 to 90 foot, it's actually a 45-degree angle on the edge of that property. So it makes it a more visually appealing transition, along with, like Salante saying, putting into the zoning, you know, you need to put this type of, you know, a roof line on, you need to put these types of brick or mortar, things that are stick with the context of what that neighborhood has been like. Even though it's a modern building, it's going to be built with materials and in the context that's fit.
It's very complex detail, actually. It's interesting if you want to take a look. You know, some neighborhoods who mandate that there's a porch, some neighborhoods who mandate that there's no porch, you know, because we don't want that. Things that come along with the porch, which I really want.
That's online, right?
Yeah,
it is
online.
The city. Yeah, there was a link on the thing that I sent you under the draft.
Okay.
Is there a way for this group of Cornell to do more public relations and communication about the plan so that residents of the city of Ithaca who Cornell has access to be able to get involved?
Yeah, the signal I got from the community relations office and from the administration when I talked to them is they think that the plan would have better luck, and we would have better luck if they kind of stayed out of it. The people who are opposing the plan right now are weary of the university. They're distrustful of the administration and the field. I mean, I think they'll understand that some people feel that the student housing is like the toxic waste, right? It's like an undesirable thing to have in your neighborhood. I know. I mean, there's some people who feel that it's an undesirable thing to have in the neighborhood, and the people who live in Bryant Park and Bell Sherman do feel like they got dealt a bad hand, and that students could have ended up congregating in any of the neighborhoods abutting the university. They could have ended up in Fall Creek or Forest Home Drive or even out in the town of Ithaca, and they ended up right there on East Hill in College Town. And they're worried that increasing the density there is only going to increase the negative externalities that they face every day, you know, when they see the red cups or the noise.
But you indicate the plan actually addresses
the situation. Mm-hmm. So that's in my opinion, the amazing part of the plan. And the people that have those sentiments as far as outline are the ones against it. When the plan, there are components in the plan that protect communities like Bryant Park and keep students out of the periphery communities where families do live. I mean, hey, it'd be nice if we can say families can live next to college students, but it doesn't work. I mean, I live not too far from it. You know, it just doesn't work very well. This plan, of course, addresses that. And, you know, and when that's a fundamental point that's brought up, like, you know, it's just, I mean, other issues that I brought up. You know,
like, so what happened is 2 years ago when I first started this, we were hearing that they wanted to make sure that students weren't attracted to the outer neighborhoods, that they didn't end up in the periphery. So we said, okay, let's densify the core to attract people into the middle, attract students in particular into the middle. The same people are now worried that having all those people in the middle, certain things are still going to spill out, like parking, for example, or noise. Like, it's only going to get louder because when it got dense there over the past 20 years, apparently it's gotten louder than in the middle of college. First, I don't believe that that's the case. But still, I think it's the lesser of two evils. I think if we let it stay how it is right now, we're going to see development keep spreading up and out. I don't know if you guys read the Ethical Journal today. We just saw that there's going to be a new apartment complex with 1,200 beds in it, not in the core of College Town, but down on State Street by Quarry. I mean, this was really traditionally very nice wood-framed houses, single-family residences. And the pressure, coupled with the fact that you can't build in the center of College Town anymore because it's too expensive, has led developers to try to make that money elsewhere. It's not good for permanent residents. I don't think it's good for students who are living further and further away from campus.
And hey, Walter, on your question about community involvement, I mean, this is, Savante chaired the CBIC, and every meeting was open to the public. when Goody Clancy first joined, there was this was the word charrette.
Yeah.
It was held in Collegetown. It was unfortunately it happened to end up on a rainy day.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, word was spread around. CBIC had landowners, students, neighborhood residents, representatives of developers. It had ways to get the word out. There's been, thankfully, a lot of articles written in the Cornell Sun, the Journal. I mean, assuredly there's people that have been sitting here and weren't as involved, but we have made every kind of reasonable effort that we could. You know, each of us have many things to do and tried to get the word out. I took the graduate special students, Ryan Singh as undergrad. You know, we've done
But do you feel like this people who could be advocates for it are still not understanding it?
I think there's always room for more advocates, but I think the best way to do it, and the reason we try to go through the assemblies, is because we wanted to make sure that opponents of the plan understood this coming from the people who work and study at the university instead of the administrators who run the university. That they really just have a distrustful, they bristle. They bristle just very viscerally.
Right? I'd like to call a question.
All in favor?
Aye.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I'll
take the question.
Yeah.
Yes. Is that a yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. 7, 8. Any opposed? Passes.
We proceed to vote.
Are you ready to vote on the resolution?
Yes.
So if Jim can give a proxy, he asked me to vote.
No, I can't give a proxy.
All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Any opposed? Abstentions? That passes.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if anybody has any more questions,
I'm available. Please send them.
Thank you for bringing this. Awesome.
Yeah.
Please, all five.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor. Your turn.
Just don't give me
I don't know. I think it's just a way out.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.